Welcome to Better Know Burner, and today I had the pleasure of getting to know John McNulty, a.k.a. Jack Trash, a.k.a. Juan Bishara, and who knows how many other names. Fascinating character. Let's get started.
Now, how you doing, Jack? John?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well.
Did I call you Jack?
Jack is great. John is great. So my wife has a running joke where it's Jack, John, Juan, and anywhere we go, she's like, it's Jack, John, Juan, whatever you want to call me.
Well, that's fitting. You yourself have always struck me as a very unique individual, and so I'm happy to be getting to know you a little bit better today.
Oh, it's great to be here, talk to you, and answer some questions, and maybe everybody can get to know me a little better. I am somebody, I like to tell stories, but the stories are never really about me. So this is kind of a nice little moment to be honest and give some little background on who I am. Hopefully.
Well, that's definitely one of the things about Love Burn. You know, there's a lot going on, and sometimes, although we have these experiences together, we don't actually spend as much time as we would like to sit down and really hear each other's stories and get to know each other a little better.
Yeah, everything seems really fast-paced, you know, and sometimes you want to make that moment. You meet somebody new, and you think, wow, this could be a friend for life, and then whoop, you don't see them for another 2 years, and then you see them again. Hey, how are you? And sometimes the chemistry can be off.
We're definitely going to scratch the surface today. Let's talk about, since the association here is with Love Burn and burns in general, let's start with, you know, your association with that and how you became a burner.
So I was, it was in the mid-90s, and we had gotten a copy of Wired magazine, and we were subscribers, my best friend Morgan and I. One night we were hanging out and we were discussing taking a trip. It was the winter and we wanted to go somewhere warm. And at the time I was in Chicago, and we had decided, and we hadn't yet decided to move to Miami Beach yet, but we were in this thing in our mid 20s where we were deciding to, maybe it's time to leave Chicago, leave the Midwest and go somewhere else. And we saw this magazine and we were just flipping through it. And there was an article on Burning Man that Brian Doherty had written. And it was basically, the title was Burning Man, the New American Holiday. And I was pretty transfixed. We were basically like, wow, this looks like a collection of weirdos and oddballs. And it would be fun to go see that, right? There was camping involved. There was a little desert, which I love. I love the desert. And I was just kind of like, oh, we should go. And so we made plans to go. And it was always conditional that if it sucked, and we kind of thought it was going to suck, we would just get up and leave. And then about 3 weeks before we were to go, I got a letter from the IRS that said, you owe us $900. So Morgan went and came back. This was 97. He came back and he was totally transfixed. He was just like, oh my God, it was the most obtuse thing. We stayed the whole time. And back then it was only 4 days. So you kind of went, it was like a Wednesday night to Sunday type thing. He came back, showed me the video, said, okay, we're going. And at that point we moved to Miami Beach. So now we live in South Beach and we said, okay, we're going to go. So then I went and I was in 98. And for me, I had always tried to find that happy blend and that happy balance between being involved in the world and not really being a part of the world. And it was apparent from the very first moment on Playa that I kind of found my people. And it was nice is because you saw a lot of people that were highly, highly intelligent, very skilled, that had normal lives, or I should say normal, you know, jobs. They hadn't really gotten on a hippie bus. And they were doing this, but they were doing some crazy things. And there was an aspect of danger. There was a different energy that was in sync with who I was, that I wasn't able to really find anywhere else. So, you know, and then as you go through these trends in burn, most people will tell you that go through that is that you enter, you, after about a year or two, you what I call the drink the Kool-Aid phase, where all of a sudden it's like, you know, you're a prophet and you're going around and you're preaching the Bible, so to speak. You're preaching the word of the Playa. And for me, it was really good. And then you kind of come back out of it. Right. Then you're like, oh, wait a minute. Whoa, wait a minute. You know, this isn't, I got to kind of get back into my life. So that was over a period of years. And then we had developed the we were the only two people that we knew that had gone to Burning Man in South Beach. And I can remember we saw one person had a bumper sticker on their car. And we stalked the car for weeks to try to find out who this other burner was. We never found out. But we ended up coming, a girl had posted on a Welcome to South Beach type of BBS type thing and said, hey, are there any burners here in South Beach? So I was completely flummoxed. I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this. I said, yes, there's two here. And then she said, oh, have you met the ones in Orlando? And it was kind of like a vampire tribe, right? We're like, what? Right. There's other vampires. You know, so the next weekend we went up to Orlando and met a bunch of people then. And, you know, and that became our thing, was like every 3 weeks, go to Orlando. There was a place called The Ranch. And, you know, a lot of us had kind of really formed early relationships out of The Ranch. And, you know, and so for me, that was really the idea of a community. Then we met the Tampa people. Right. And so it was nice that, and I think what's special about the Florida burner community, as opposed to other communities that I know of, is because we're kind of spread out, there's this nice little 3-hour fence between us, is we're excited to see each other every time we see each other. Whereas if we all lived in the same hip city, I don't think we would be as close as we are now. We're all, you know, a lot of us have known each other for 20 plus years. And that's special. It, you know, we kind of evolve, and now I see us and I see pictures of who we were and photos of who we are. And I think, wow, look at that. We are literally growing old together. There we are, young, and then we're old. So, you know,
that leads me to ask you about the Burning Retirement Acres, the project that.
So Burning Acres was always kind of this joke, you know, at 4:30 in the morning when you're sitting around kind of messed up around a fire and you think about, you know, what is it that's really important to you? And you realize that it's your relationships, and you sit there and you think, well, how do we keep these relationships to the end? How do we keep this community going? And you realize that it started out as kind of a tongue in cheek thing. And then we realized as we got older, when we started to see our parents get older, you start to see, you get closer to that age. I'm 52 now. And, you know, I'm not necessarily ready to go to retirement, but you start thinking about it because you start saying to yourself, well, what is that going to look like? What's 72 look like? And for the most part, I see a lot of isolation. I see a lot of people doing things, living a retirement that maybe they didn't really want. And I see them just being alone. And for me, coming from a community like we have, I always think, like, how can we make it synergistic so that we can be together? And, you know, it goes from, oh, it'd be great if we had a couple of hundred of us, to, hey, it'd be great if there's only 8 of us on like 7 acres of land where there's like 5 houses and where, you know, you got to kind of wave across the porch and maybe you ring a bell and that's your community dinner, you know, once a week. Versus the communal, right? So everybody has an idea of how that looks. And you realize, you're like, okay, you know, space is an important thing, and then density. So the idea that we have now is basically, as I realize, for me, I would like variety. I would like to be able to every 6 months go to another location and stay there. And then after 4 or 5 months, you're excited to go to the next location. So the idea is kind of this, you know, maybe having 10 or 13 of these small locations throughout the country that you can go to and you stay at and you, you know, live your life, but it's not necessarily your retirement home.
Sure. No, that's fascinating.
A little more transient. It's like you might have an anchor place that's your place, but for a part of the year, you're out and about and you're seeing your friends and hanging out and doing stuff. Because I realize as we all go through this, and people, you know, we all develop pretty deep relationships with each other. But you want to do more than anything is take care of each other. And so you realize, like, well, how can I do that from a distance? And it's really hard, you know. I mean, we have things now, social media, but every so often, that doesn't really help. You have to get together. And I even find that burns become less about the party and more about just catching up with people and seeing everybody, seeing how they're doing, you know, and like I said, growing old together, doing these things. And so it's funny. I have this vision in the future of, it's kind of like the Shriners are at a parade. where there'll be a parade and, you know, the parents would be telling, hey, kids, here comes the burners. And it's these old burners and like they're messed up art cars and they're like furry pants and, you know, got, you know, crappy techno music going down the street. And they're like, wow, those people are just stuck in 2003. Boy, they never, you know. So I just imagine it's kind of like, you know, funny cars and different things. And, you know,
I like your vision.
Yeah. You know, because it, in the end, it's kind of that, like who you are. I don't think you should ever have to leave that behind. I think you just have to fit it into the age you are. You know, one of the things that was interesting about living in South Beach was you saw a lot of older people trying to hang on to youth. And it's a dangerous thing. There comes a point where you go from a good attempt to being slightly pathetic. So I've always been hyper aware of that. Like you never want to be to the point where you're just like, ah, look at that. That's kind of sad. You know, kind of hang on to something that you're not anymore. So Burning Acres has always been this transitional goal. It's a philosophical, you know, point to say, well, look at this. Now I'm a crotchety old burner and I'm going to go, you know, move into Burning Acres. It's kind of that proverbial, you know.
It's an evolution,
It's an evolution of the sort because that's the new territory, right? That's the new thing, right? We were all young. We were all naked in the desert and sexy and doing all that stuff. But then there comes a point where you're like, you know, it's like, I'm going to go to bed, you know, take it easier. Hey, can you turn that down a little bit? You know, so there's always that you have to kind of put yourself out there to the retirement side of the event.
Let's loop back now and let's talk about that naked youth. Where'd you grow up? Tell me about your.
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up on the south side of Chicago in a neighborhood called Beverly, and it is a predominantly Irish Catholic community. When I was born, my father was a Chicago police officer, and so you know it's your stereotypical Irish Catholic boy upbringing. I was an altar boy. Went to Catholic schools, all boys high school, Catholic school, you know, and it was great. Out of 66 kids in my eighth grade graduating class, there's only 9 of us that don't live in the neighborhood now. So it's very insular. People stay there. It's a great community. You know, everybody cross marries and then you buy your aunt's house or you move into your grandma's house. So, you know, and to me, that wasn't really who I was. I was kind of a different kid, you know, closeted different kid, meaning that I wasn't really able to kind of come out. In my neighborhood, it was, if you were a creative kid, there was this tone that was given to you, you know, there was a word that was kind of harsh, but you were like a fag, and it didn't mean that you were gay. It just meant you were different. But it was said in such a tone that you never wanted that associated with it. And I had had creative influences in my life. I have an uncle that was very creative and his nickname is Uncle Weirdo. And I am now the Uncle Weirdo in my family. And so it's great to kind of, you know, inherit the mantle, so to speak. But as a kid, I was very, you know, I didn't really deal with it well because I wanted to do this stuff. And anytime I would do something creatively, people didn't really understand how that fit into making money or how that fit into a lifestyle or how that fit into anything, because it just wasn't really that area. It's changed a lot since then. I mean, that was the 70s, but it's changed a lot since then. People now, the area has gotten a little funkified and has become a little more open-minded. But at the time, it was just a little bit like that. But, you know, my family's still there in Chicago. You know, and I go back often and see everybody, but, you know, at the time it wasn't for me. So as a, in my 20s, you know, I knew I had to get out because I just knew everybody. It was too comfortable. Chicago, as large as Chicago is, it's actually a very small provincial town. If you grew up in certain neighborhoods, you tend to know everybody and everybody knows you. And so you have like, there's accountability of family. And I kind of wanted to get away from that and just be separate from it.
That's been the foundational experience and tale of a lot of rap songs and movies about struggle to get out.
Yeah. In a weird way, I would never say it's heroic, but there's a sort of hero's journey, right, to a creative spirit where you have to leave and go find that, you know, you have to find your voice, you have to do your things. I had wanted to go out. I always felt like I hadn't seen the world. And, you know, I went to school at the University of Illinois, which is in Champaign, Illinois. It's only 2 hours away from Chicago. So it really was, I mean, not that far. And there wasn't much. And I always had kind of a sense for adventure in my heart. And when I was 23 years old, I decided to follow the path of Alexander the Great from northern Greece all the way to Egypt. So I went to all the battle sites of Alexander the Great and spent 6 months just hitchhiking all over. And it really opened my eyes to the varieties of life and the varieties of a living experience. And, you know, when I came back from then you're cooked, right? And then, you know, if you're lucky and you are able to take a trip where you're a traveler and not a tourist at a young age, you're damned for life because you just want to, you want to meet everybody. You want to meet every person in the world. You want to hear every story in the world. And so that kind of indirectly helped me, but it also totally screwed me because at the time I felt like, wow, I want to be a success in business. And, you know, the proto internet was just taking off. I was heavy into technology and I thought like, wow, I can make a lot of money. And then when I kind of came back and then I started seeing the creative people, and then thankfully for Burning Man, I realized that just wasn't who I was. And, you know, you have to kind of find who you are. You have to find out who you're not, and then you have to find out who you are. So, you know, there's sort of this thing, leave home. You know, and at first it's hard because people at home, they might feel like you're rejecting them, and you're not. You're just like, I just need to go find something. I need to go, you know, search for whatever it is I'm looking for.
Yeah, makes sense.
I think that's a common story among a lot of burners is that there's this sort of, you know, there's this leave, you go out, you do this certain, and then just kind of a return home.
Yeah, you can't put the small town boy back in the box after seeing the world.
I don't think so. And even though I was from a big city, I was from a small neighborhood in that big city. And you just have to, I think you have to leave. You have to go somewhere for a while. And there's other cultures in this world that encourage it. You know, one of the things that's great about backpacking to far crazy corners of the world, there's always an Australian or there's always a Kiwi there because they're so remote. They're encouraged to go see the world for 3-4 years and then come back. You know, they go back to Australia and then they're done. So it was really encouraging because you just don't see Americans and you definitely don't see, you know, people from my neighborhood in these nooks and crannies of the world. So for me, that was always the affirmation that, okay, this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, it's definitely my experience as well. Were there any other really foundational experiences as a young lad that kind of?
Well, you know, people who know me well will tell you that I can't hear for shit. And the reason is because I'm deaf in my right ear. I am like 96% deaf in my right ear. And we didn't discover it. My parents didn't find us out until the city of Chicago, when you're going into kindergarten, every child is required in the public schools to take a hearing test and a vision test. And so up until that point, I didn't go to school. I was just in a constant state of befuddlement and always perplexed. I just never knew. I had no clue what was going on. People would say things to me and I just couldn't understand. A good way to explain it is I can hear it, but it would sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. You know, like, wah, 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 wah. And I was just as a kid. So what happened was, is I had to imagine a lot. It really jump-started my imagination because I was constantly trying to figure out what were people telling me. And I was always wrong. So I can remember, I mean, little stories like, you know, they tell you bring in a rug for nap time in kindergarten. Well, she probably told me 10 times, but I never really heard her or understood her. So I never brought in a rug. So after a while, she just gave up and said, you can sleep on the hardwood floor. So the other kids had their nice little rugs, you know, they're like bathroom rugs. And then I would sleep on the hardwood floor. And now I love to sleep on hardwood floors because, you know, it's just those weird things like that. But what it did was it forced me to. So when we found out, they gave my parents an option and they said, you know, we don't know how he is with learning. You know, he's never been to school, but We're going to get him a hearing aid. The hearing aid will help him a little bit. It's more for people to know, right? It's kind of like you put a sign on your head that says, I can't hear, because now you got this big bulky. And this was the 70s. And I think at the time, I remember my parents telling me, don't lose this at the playground, because this cost us $450, which was a fortune to us. And of course, 2 weeks into it, I lose it at the playground and we found it. But it, you know, it was the same color as like leaves. It was the fall, and you know, it took 2 hours.
Right.
We had every kid in the school looking for the hearing aid. So yeah, it's, and so what they did was they said, look, we can either teach him sign language. It's going to be a lot, or maybe you can go to special school, or we can do some lip reading classes. And I said, well, let's do the lip reading. So I went to, I would go down every couple of days a week and do lip reading classes. And I'm going to tell you, Paul, it was the greatest thing that could have ever happened, because it forced me to really focus and listen to people. And all of a sudden, it was like I was given a primer to comprehension, to understanding. So my mind had been working so hard to make sense of things I couldn't understand, that all of a sudden it just magically unlocked this whole world where all of a sudden people could talk to me, and because I could read their lips, I could understand what they were saying right off the bat. And it made me excited again, because you're just not in a state of confusion. And I've seen it with people, and they have their kids, and we've caught a couple of kids. Parents say, you know, my daughter's out of it. She's always kind of in this haze and all this stuff. And I said, you know, get her ears checked. And sure enough, there'll be some sort of auditory affliction, because they just had an infection, or maybe there's something not right. And they get a hearing aid, and they do some sort of remedial instruction. They become much more in tune to the world. There's still hundreds of moments every day where I just don't get it. Right. Somebody says something to me, you know, my wife, God bless her, has incredible patience, because I have to get up and go into the room if she's saying something, or she has to come and kind of get in front of me to let me know. If I'm driving and you're in the back seat and I can't see you in the mirror, you know, things like that. There's always these workarounds. But what it did give me was an intense ability to sit and read for hours on end without the distractions that people usually have of a running toilet, or you know, whatever it is that you hear. I don't have those things. So
let's talk about that a little bit, because you're one of the most voracious readers that I know. You read a number, how many books a week do you?
I usually read like probably right now I'm on like 3 to 4 a week.
That's amazing.
But I've had some periods in my life where it's been a book a night. It depends on what else is going on. Because right now, you know, the winter is coming, so there's a lot less activity outside. That all came about. I haven't had an uncle who is a big reader, and he right away would ask me all the time, because he knew I was real quiet, and he would say, do you read? And I'd have a book, you know, it's like a little Encyclopedia Brown, or something, you know, like Scholastic book. And I can remember in second grade, he took it out of my hands. He says, don't read those books anymore. And he gave me a copy of Plato's Republic. And he said, just read this. He said, don't worry if you don't know any of the words. Don't worry about it. Just plow through it. And I can remember it was like, you know, putting a big lead vest on and, you know, having to walk. You know, I was like, oh my God, I can't even understand this. But you kind of plow through it. And I never wanted to let him down. So he would ask me questions about it. And so you kind of work your way through the kinks, where you get over the fear of the big boy books, I guess, for lack of a better word. And so I was always encouraged, you know, and he would have a secret stash of books that he would give me and say, oh, don't tell your cousins I'm giving you these books. And there would be books on advanced astronomy or things. And he was very good about telling me, don't worry about not knowing something. He says, just go to the next part, get what you know. You can reread it. And it was a way to learn from books. And then there was a girl in my class who was a very fast reader. And I was super competitive about reading. So at the time, I don't know if you remember this, there was the Evelyn Wood speed reading course advertised on TV. Yeah.
Yep.
So you would see these people, right? And they're doing the finger and they're going like, you know, read hundreds of books a year. And I was like, how did they do that? There's no way they can do that. And then I remember reading something about reading, and it was kind of this like trick. And then all of a sudden it just made sense. And so, you know, reading is, to me, is a very enjoyable thing. It's a meditation. Good books, you know, good stuff. And then when I got to school, to the university, I thought at the time, you know, it's the 80s, everybody wants to be like a Gordon Gekko and be in a business and get an MBA. And I had some friends that were in the poetry, English literature. They were poetry majors. And I was reading all their stuff. And they're like, well, why are you doing that? Do you like it? I said, no, I hate it. I hate all these people in my class. They're all like, you know, Gordon Gekko types. And I went to a couple of the poetry parties, and that was my jam. These people were weird, right? All the girls were, you know, I was known as the guy that loved weird girls. So the weirder, the better. Everybody would be like, oh, you should meet her roommate. You think she's weird? Meet her roommate. I'd be in love before we even met. And it, to me, that was the whole thing. So then I transferred my major over to poetry, and that was great. However, as you know, there's not a lot of jobs for poetry majors out there. And, you know, it's not really, I think of poetry as something like, it gives you an appreciation of the poetry of life and a way to create a song about the experiences that you go through in everyday life. You know, you read enough poetry, your internal dialogue becomes poetic. I think so, at least.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the thing is, even now, every so often when I get into a funk, I'll just read some poetry. You know, I'll read some Frost or read something. And it kind of takes you away from that, because now you're in somebody else's emotions and somebody else's observations and perspectives. And you get away from your own little pity party and your own little, you know, circular thing that we all get into.
Do you have a favorite poet?
I don't. You know, I have a favorite writer, which is Henry Miller. Henry Miller, to me, is you know, if you're lucky, you read enough until you find somebody that you're like, oh my God, this guy is reading like my soul, right? He's writing my thoughts. He's, as I'm reading, my thoughts are in mesh. And so if you're lucky and you find that, then you want to read everything. And so it's good to have that. I have a large collection of his books. And, you know, I like the arc of certain people where you can start to see like, okay. And I try to match my life at certain phases with the writers so that I can see, because when you're young, sometimes you're reading the writings of maybe an older woman. There's a disconnect because you just haven't gone through the same level of experiences. And then when you read the words, like right now, if I read the words of a man who's 72, I can kind of relate a little more than I could when I was 25.
Right.
So, you know, reading is always this re-referencing, you know. So when people say, why do you save books? I said, well, I save the books. They're these little time capsules that I want to go back to later on.
We only live one life. And to a certain extent, but through books, you can experience the life of multiple people.
Oh, multiple hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, and it's great when you hit a good one, for whatever reason, they're good, whether it's good stories or, you know, good stuff. It's great. It's a magical moment. And you want to tell everybody. And those who know me that might be listening to this will know that I will give them books and then be like, so did you like it? Did you like it? Did you like it? And they'll be like, I haven't read it yet. I'm like, what are you doing? It's been 2 months. So people are busy, or they just don't, you know, have the same passion. In the meantime, they'll do the same thing. They're like, well, did you listen to that CD I gave you of my latest, you know, mix? I'm like, nah, I haven't listened to it. And they're like, well, what are you doing? So it's all the same. Yeah. You know, my fantasy of a thing would be to be a writer. But what happens is when you read a lot, you become hypercritical of yourself, and that you can't, I have a hard time turning that voice off, because all I do is I see this great corpus of other writers. And I think of, I look at my stuff and I go, this is absolute shit. Right. Instead of realizing that it's a creative process that you just have to go through, and you have to get rid of the judginess of every page by page judginess. You just have to write it. You have to tell the story.
That was going to be one of my questions, whether you were writing or not.
I write a lot, and I use it, believe it or not, I use Facebook as an outlet, as a creative outlet, because it's kind of a quirky audience, and, you know, it's kind of for your friends. So it's a safe audience, and humor is a funny thing there. You can be snarky, and I have a sense of sarcasm, and people will get it, especially in the friend. I have a very, I don't want to say it's a restricted friend list, but it's just like, I just know who's going to be in it. So it's kind of a nice way to try out some ideas. And then I realize a lot of it is that, well, why are you writing, right? Is it for fame? That's not really a good reason to write, right? Is it for money? Not really. Yeah, you do something you love to do for money, you no longer will love to do it. I believe that. So, you know, I enjoy doing some poetry. I enjoy doing some stuff. I just had something happen 2 weeks ago where I had a book that I've had like for 3 years, a journal. And I had a whole bunch of stuff. I have kind of notes on these two books that I'm kind of, specking out and doing character development for these two novels I want to write. What happens? I lose it on a plane, on a United flight. I lost it. I left it in the little thing in front. And it's like 3 years, probably a couple hundred pages of writing and some poems and things like that and notes and observations. And it's gone, you know, and I go to the website. And yet it's also an exercise in letting go, because I know that if you ask me, I could probably remember almost everything that's in that book. But it's having that book, right? It's that thing, right? You look at it and you do this stuff. And so I was down for like 2 days, and I very rarely get down about material things. But that one I did. I was like, fuck, this is horrible. I just lost us. How bad am I, right? You know, I just carelessly walked away from it. But
it's quite an experience. Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's just, you know, but it's not, you can reproduce it. And I think what's great about the Burning Man art and creativity is that it's a regenerative process, right? So you build something, it's temporary, it's not forever. You do a theme camp or you do some art or you do a project, and then maybe it just doesn't fit for the next year. So it just goes somewhere else. And maybe somebody else uses it. They build on top of it. You know, we burn things, we destroy things. All those experiences prepares me for just losing something like that. That's kind of personal. You know, I kind of have this like weird fantasy that somebody cleaning the airplane took the book and took it home and said, hey, look at this weirdo. And that maybe one of their kids is like, oh, I love this book. And then they're reading it and there's whatever. You know, you want to think that it's out there flying around somewhere. It has a new life.
Maybe you'll find it in the bookstore someday.
Yeah, maybe the FBI will show up. You know, maybe the FBI will show up because they figured out and they're like, oh, yeah, we need to talk to you about something.
Too funny. So people in general, obviously you're a student of human nature and you have an interesting cast of characters around you and you appreciate different things about them. Do you want to talk about that a little bit or?
Yeah, so you know, I will say, if you're lucky in life to surround yourself with people who are interesting and quirky, and you have the patience to allow them to be themselves, you're very fortunate. Like I consider myself very, very lucky for the friends that I have, and you know, and that's the thing about these communities, whether you. Whatever community you're in, if you're lucky and you have these close relationships, these people inspire you. You know, I get inspired by a lot of people that I work with at Love Burn. I get inspired by a lot of people. When we had Circus Basura that really did these things. And for me, it's one of those things in life that you don't ever want to lose, right? You don't want to lose the people you love. And you have to do that thing, you know, and I think there's always been a nice, one of the things that's nice about, and this is a little side diversion, but I'll get back to you, one of the things that's nice about drugs and teaching you is drug is a teacher. Drugs can be a teacher. And eventually you don't need the drug, right? So you have this moment where you just think like, oh my God, this is wonderful. Here I am with all these people and you're just telling people you love them. And after a while, you're like, well, why do I need the drug or the drink to do that? Right. You start thinking like, well, maybe I don't need this at all. Maybe I can just tell them, hey, I love you and I miss you. And once you break through that intimacy, you find out it comes back. So, you know, for me, it's always been about the inspiration that people give me. And I get inspired by so many people that I'm close to that they're working on little projects or they're doing these things or just how they deal with their life. You know, if you're lucky enough and they let me in to, hey, I'm having a bad day, but I think I'm going to get through it. And here's how I'm going to get through it. That to me is inspiring because we all tend to, or at least I do, I tend to live in a kind of an insular bubble where you have your things and you just think nobody can really understand. Well, it turns out we all have common issues and we all have common things. And the sooner you can explain it to somebody in a way that's a common language, the easier it is for somebody to say, I understand, or I empathize with you, or I have been there. And then when that happens, you're like, okay, well, they're getting through it. They got through it. I can get through it. And I think that's the whole thing, the struggle for me. And I, what I've noticed now in my life is the transition going from a student to kind of being an example or a mentor. I mean, I don't have any direct people that I, you know, whatever, but you kind of, you age into an example, I guess. And I just finished reading this book on talking about elders and communities. And it's one of those things where, you know, being an elder doesn't mean you're necessarily the old person. It doesn't mean you're the wisest person. But what it means is that you have assumed this responsibility of somebody that people can kind of look to and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? What can we do? And I'm not saying that's necessarily where I'm going, but there's an appreciation for that stage in your life. Right. And there's an appreciation for that. People can say, oh, you know, I have this thing. How did you do it? How did you do that? Or how did you do this? And that to me is really the thing. You know, that's why I stay engaged in Love Burn. And why I stay engaged is not for the fun, the personal fun for myself. It's for the inspiration, but it's also to kind of pay it forward. I had an experience in 2001 that was really kind of instrumental. So what had happened was in 2001, I worked DPW on the playa. And I had this whole thing. I quit a job. I'd saved some money up. And I had this thing called the Summer of Love. And in the Summer of Love, basically, it was I was just going to do anything I can do for anybody who asked me to do something for them. And I can remember I wrote a letter just to like info@burningman.com.org. And I said, you know, do you need people to help? And they said, yes, we need people to help. So I went out there and worked out there for 2 months. And it was a phenomenal experience. And I got to work on the temple, which was the first real year the temple was built in 2001 with David Best. So after I was done with DPW stuff, I would eat dinner and then I would go and spend the night and work with the temple for a couple of nights. And it was great to see this because he was an older fella in the organization. And he was somebody who had this thing. And I don't know if you know anything about how that first temple happened, but he and his friend Jack, they had lost another friend who had been into a motorcycle accident, leaving Burning Man 2 years before. And they decided to build the temple in his honor. And that was kind of the thing. And when I heard the story, somebody had mentioned it to me. And they kind of kept it on the DL. It was a kind of, they were building this crazy temple structure, but you didn't really know why. So it was late at night. And this is like maybe 3 or 4 days before the event. And he was there with his partner, Jack. They were the two guys building it. And we were just kind of talking about the project and it was pretty wrapped up. And you know, I went up to him and I said, David, you know, I said, I would love and I would give anything to have friends like you two are to your friend and what you've built. And he stood up and he gently put his two hands on my shoulders and he looked me straight in the eyes and he says, Jack, you have friends like us. We're those friends. And it didn't necessarily mean that he was saying that he's a friend to me. What it meant was, is it was this general idea that if you allow it to happen, it can happen. And it was like a diamond bullet had been shot right into my brain. This illumination occurred where I just walked away. And there was, at the time, there was this thing called the plastic chapel. It was a big chapel made out of plastic parts and recycled parts. And I just broke down. I broke down crying. I laid down on the ground. I was tired. I was exhausted. But it was this outpouring of this genuine acceptance and this idea that you can let people into your life and you can be that person for them too, if you want it. And that changed me. I mean, it really did. I came home from that experience in 2001 and I said, I want to try to be anything I can be to anybody that asked me to help and give them that same sense of community. So I have always kind of been somebody that has gone out, found people, if you ask a lot of people, how did they get involved in Burning Man? It kind of, they met me somewhere and then I brought them in. Right. So it's kind of like the vampire origin story. Who made you a vampire? You know, I've done it for a lot of people.
That's great.
And what's great is that when you do that, it's nice to see then they bring in people and they bring in people. And it kind of, you know, has this whole kind of what was the commercial, Perel, or what was the hair commercial? And so on. And she tells two friends and she tells two friends and on and on. And that's kind of how that community grows to the point now where it's really growing, you know, and you look at these things and you start, you know, you have these things. When Brian Wiener and I did Maker Square and Elaine, we did Maker Square because when we did Circus Basura, so many people were just so excited to be working on something that we said, wow, this would be great if we had an organization that worked on like building things that you could just, everybody could kind of pass the hat, you pay a monthly fee and we could do this. And we looked around for spaces for about a year and a half until we found the right space. And then that created a whole nice community of people that didn't know anything about burners. And we tried really hard to keep that separate. We didn't do too well. So, you know, there's a thing about, you know, never go, you know, I have this joke about never go full clown, or you should never go full burner. And full burner is like, it's too much for some people. They just want to come and work on and build some shelves, right? They don't want to have this whole burner thing around.
He wants to work on the car. He doesn't need
it. Yeah, they just want to work on a project. They just want to have a thing to do. They don't necessarily want to have all the, you know, the burner energy. If you're not receptive, if your tuning fork is not tuned into the burner frequency, it can be kind of I don't want to say a repulsive thing, but it can be an unwanted thing. And you have to be very careful about that. So I was always very careful. But then at some point, you know, then we had the bar, we had the club, and it just became like, you know, people were like, well, what is it? Is this a maker space or is this like a burner club? And it was like, well, yeah, it can be anything. Some people don't really like that. And so we learned these lessons as we went through. But one of the things that was great about that environment is you really got the focus on the idea of creativity and what is creativity. Because at Burning Man and some of the regional events, you see the results of creativity. But there's a lot of people, great people, that would come to me and say, man, I really want to build this, but I'm just not creative. And you realize, wow, that's your hook word right there. Because there's a desire to be creative. They don't think they're creative, but in fact, they really are. They just haven't really been trained. And you can train people in creativity and not necessarily in the creative aspect that they're going to do, the medium or whatever it is. It's more of a kind of a general attitude. And what's great about the playa was you go around and walk around and see so much that you're like, how the fuck did they do that? How the hell did they do that? And you just say, man, I want to learn how to do that. Or I'm going to go get my forklift license. Or I'm going to be a welder. Or I'm going to do this. Those inspiring things, it create this enabling can-do attitude. I was involved in a project in 2012 with some other burners where we were going to take a 175-foot casino boat in Fort Pierce. And we were basically going to turn it into a Burning Man at sea. So the boat had been purchased by the Seasteader Institute, which is this libertarian think tank that's out in San Francisco. They contacted me because we were in South Florida. And I said, oh, my wife is a yachtie. She works in yachts. So she has a lot of experience with yacht certifications. And oh, this is great. You both want to work with us. So then all these other burners came. There was about nine of us. And we were going to create this Burning Man at sea. So you can try to guess where it was going because it was all this energy, right? There's a spirit. When you get burners together, I worked with Burners Without Borders in Peru for 2 months after an earthquake. Hands down, the most can-do group of people out there among all the other NGOs were the burners because there was a sort of like, we would always say it was this little rascals that are having, little rascals are throwing a play energy. Right. It's like, we can do it. And even if you didn't know what the hell you were doing, there's just like, well, we're burners and we can do anything. And sometimes you fall flat on your face and you embarrass yourself. But so what? It's funny. And you're trying it. And so you see that energy. And we had the ship and the coast. We met with the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard's like, well, you know, just so you know, you're going to get arrested in every port you pull into because of what you're doing with this boat. You can't do that. You have to be properly vetted and assured, and you just can't float. Right. What we found out was, is we took this long course and we found out that there's more rules at sea than there are, than you think there are. Right. There's a whole maritime law, and people have this fantasy about international waters being this kind of freehold area. And it turns out that's not the case at all. And so, you know, we were going to raise livestock on the boat. You know, we're going to put a helicopter pad on it. It was basically going to be like Robot Heart at sea. And it was a, you know, and it lasted like a week and a half until the whole thing just flamed out because people don't realize just how expensive ships are. Right. And we had somebody with deep pockets, but he didn't have pocket that deep. And you're just like, oh, my God. So but the reason I bring that up is that can do spirit has, I think, infused itself into the world, that there's been a lot of these startups, a lot of things that have come out of that can do spirit, where people have a great year with the camp on the playa, or maybe they have something where all of a sudden those people get together and say, well, let's do this in the real world. Let's try this here. That is the thing that I get the biggest jazz out of, is seeing those little traces out there. You start seeing the art, you start seeing the meow wolves, you start seeing this level of interactivity going on, where it's kind of like, you know, pushing people out of their shells. And, you know, it's hard to make money on it. It's hard to do it for a living because you love it so much, right? You know, as soon as there's always that weird uncanny valley where you find yourself doing something that's very burnerish until you, like, you know, start doing it. So, you know, then you start doing it and then you feel icky because you're making money doing it. Does that make sense?
How do you mesh the real world with your burner philosophy? How are you?
You know, a lot of it is as well. So I'm sure there's many people out there that are like this, but it's always kind of on a QT, right? We have our little dark secret and you don't tell people at work, right? For years, I used to tell people that my dad was obsessed with camping in Reno and that every year he insists that the whole family goes camping in Reno at this particular time. And that was the only way I could really do it. And it was funny because over the years, people would be like, hey, you were out there with your family camping. Were you anywhere near this burning thing? I'd be like, oh, we saw those people in the airport. Oh, my God, they are so annoying. You know, because I just didn't really want the questions. Right. And then maybe in about the last 10 years, I started realizing that it's okay to do that. Like there's just kind of a change in the general acceptance. It got away from being drug infused orgy to where now everybody has a cousin or knows somebody that goes and, hey, that guy's pretty normal, or hey, she loves it, you know, and she's a school teacher, you know, whatever it is, right? There's kind of a general social acceptance of it. I find that a lot of it is the enthusiasm. That's how I infuse it into life. That kind of that can do spirit is to bring that in. And I get it refreshed with, you know, after Love Burn. There always comes a point during Love Burn, I have it every year personally, where I think it's like, who's like Murtaugh in the Mel Gibson cop movie where he says, I'm getting too old for this shit. Right. There comes a moment where I'm like, oh, I'm getting too old for this shit. And I realize that you go through that whole arc. And then afterwards, you're like, oh, man, that was great. I'm so glad I do this. And I'm so glad I'm involved in this. And I'm so glad to catch up with these people. So, and that's normal. And I used to think it was me, and I talked to everybody, and everybody says the same thing. They're like, oh, man, I always think I'm too old for this shit. You know, like, when is it going to stop? And I think that's the part, is you bring that into it. I will say that it has made me jaded when it comes to art in the world. I can remember after a while going to art museums and being like, well, where do I press the button on the painting? You know, that it does something, you know, does it shoot fire? Does it move? Does it make a fart noise? What's it do? Right. After a while, you become kind of like, yeah, I guess so. And, you know, you meet people who are bona fide artists and you're like, oh, you're just a painter.
Yeah, it's definitely odd to pay. It's definitely odd to pay for art or events that aren't half as interesting as a burn.
It is. It's hard. And it's hard. You go to craft fairs, right? And you become this person. They're like, I can make that. I can make that. I can make that. I can make that. Why am I here? What am I going to buy? You know, and then you go through the whole arc. Then you're like, I just want to buy that to support the person. I can make that. But I really want to just buy that $15 thing to support that person because they're earnestly, you know, selling it. But you go through all these permutations of like creativity. And, you know, now I find myself, you know, just about ready to start up a whole new creative spurt. I've been in kind of a funk for a couple of years doing, Lane and I have been working through a lot of things things that we've owned that we're trying to sell and whatever. We're out of that. And I think now this is going to start a whole new chapter of creativity. So now the idea really is where I am, which is in a rural area outside of Cleveland, there's none of that. And so it's nice to bring a little color and a little vibe to this little corner of the world and try that out, you know. So, the search, once again, the search comes on where it's like, go find the weirdos and build it again. But it's hard. It's hard when you have really good friends and people that you love so much because you can't replace them and you don't want to replace them. They're just not physically in proximity to them. Right. I won't randomly come see you on Friday night. Whereas before I would. And so that's a part that you kind of miss when you're away. You know, so my advice to anybody listening, if you move, don't feel like you have to leave your friends because you don't. You know, you can still be involved in their lives. You're just not physically present.
You just, along those lines, you just had an event at your place.
We did. So what we did is we did a summer camp and we had about 35 people come up here. And it was great. You know, it was great seeing everybody here. People have a misconception of Ohio because there's two parts to Ohio. There's a western part that's very flat, like Indiana, Illinois, Iowa. And then there's an eastern part, which is very hilly, and it's more like Pennsylvania. So we're in the eastern part. So people would be like, wow, it's really hilly here. It's beautiful, and it's just nice. I said, yeah, it is very nice. It's a nice little corner of the world to be in.
Tell us about your place there.
So it is 6 acres, and right now we're up to 37 chickens. So we got the chickens kind of on a lark, and I really like the chickens now. They become, if you talk to people in the area, they'll say, don't make your chickens your pets, but it's too late, and you have an affection for them, and, you know, you look forward to getting up in the morning and feeding them and taking care of them and doing the things, and you talk to them, and, you know, you have that there. The place here, it's nice. It's hilly. One part's open. The other part is like kind of a deep old woods. So it's the original old woods that's never been plowed or done. So a lot of areas in Ohio, they were converted in the 1830s, 1820s in this area into farmland. That area wasn't. So we have some giant American sycamores that are probably like 160, 170 years old. In the back there, and they're massive trees. And so for me, that's something growing up in a city that I just am completely clueless about. I don't know anything about it. So I'm trying to learn. I just got a book on mushrooms the other day because we have tons of different variety of mushrooms. And I don't need to know the names so much. I just want to kind of know, you know, the tree, how the tree lives, what it does, why is it there and not over there, you know, all that different stuff. Because it's fun, I think, in one way, to be stupid. You have to, I think you, in life, you have to put yourself in situations all the time where you're stupid, where you don't know anything, right? And so I'll tell you one little thing right now. So I just started a course. I have been knocking DJs for 20-something years. I just signed up. We got an Oculus VR, and I just signed up for DJ classes. And I now have a new respect for DJs, good DJs, because it's not hard. It's not easy. It's there's some technical difficulty and there's an understanding of music that has to occur. But before I looked at it as like just pressing buttons and doing it. And so it's the same thing, right? And then when I do it, I'm like, man, I suck. And that's the fun thing. I love to say I suck because that means I'm putting myself into an uncomfortable situation. And I'm going to learn something from it.
What type of music do you listen to, or what do you listen to?
I am heavy. The first love is always jazz. my first love was jazz. And, you know, I grew up as a saxophone player. I've been playing saxophone since I was 8. And, you know, the first couple of years you play, you hate it. And then when you hear somebody really good for the first time in your life, you're like, wow, now I love it. And so I played that and, you know, some other instruments, and I was never really good technically, but I think every child should take up an instrument so that you know what good music is, you know, who a good musician is, and you understand the good tonalities of it. I have one of my guilty pleasures is deep house music. And, you know, so it's like if I have headphones on, I'm listening to like a deep house mix. And the only reason this is because it's kind of innocuous music, right? There's just a steady beat going, so you can do yard work or you can kind of work around the house or do whatever. But because of my hearing and my problem with my hearing, I don't like words with songs in it. I mean, songs with words in it, because it's like people go, oh, wow, that song's so meaningful. And I don't understand any of the words in it.
They're highly overrated usually. So.
Usually. But then I like to read the lyrics sometimes. I'm like, ah, so that's what they were saying, right? So a game my friends and my sister used to play on me all the time was they would play a song, like Eye of the Tiger, right? They would play a song and say, okay, what are they saying? And whatever I said back was never what they were really singing. And so they'd be like, man, you're an idiot. I go, what are they saying? And they said, oh, you know, it's the thrill of the fight. And I would be like, no, 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 it's the hill and the light. And they're like, no, 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 you know. So to this day, if it's got words in it or if it's a song, like if it's a, I'm not going to listen to it. But all types of music. I mean, we have music playing here constantly in the house. You know, music is a pervasive thing. I grew up with music in the neighborhood I grew up with. So I didn't know any white music until I got to college. So I grew up on funk and early house music and early, you know, like early 80s. We had a station called BMX in Chicago, WBMX and WGCI. Those two stations were just fused on my little boombox. And it was basketball music, you know, you played in the alley, you played basketball to this music. And so it wasn't until I got to college that people would be like, oh, you know who this is? I go, no. And they go, oh, that's Pink Floyd. That's The Doors. I'm like, no, I don't know. And then I would say, okay, well, let me play some music. And, you know, they'd be like, I don't know who that is. I'm like, that's Grandmaster Flash. How can you not know that? So, you know, for me, that was always a heavy influence. And so I never felt like I was involved in music, you know, the industry of music. I mean, there's some great music out there, but I wouldn't know it. And I think maybe you can relate to this, that there comes a point in your life where you see what's like, it's the Saturday Night Live thing. I can remember watching Saturday Night Live as a kid with my parents. And my dad would be like, I don't know who the hell any of these singers are. And you knew, of course, because you were a kid. Now, that's me. You know, somebody will come on and I'm like, I don't know who the hell that is. And they'll be like, well, that's Chance the Weeknd. You know, or that's so-and-so. Or that's Dua Lipa. I'm like, I don't know who the hell that is. You know, and so you, it's nice to kind of be that way. Where you're like, oh man, it just never ends. Music is, it never ends. There's so much out there now. And I really truly believe we live in a golden age now where you can just get any music you want, anytime you want. You know, that to me. I mean, you're a big music listener?
I am. I go on usually a Spotify trip.
Right.
The AI on Spotify is really honed in on what I like. Let's you know what you talked about. We talked about it. I almost hate to go in the direction of the modern day, but let's talk about the world as it is today and your perception of it and thoughts about where we are.
I am, if you were to put me in a box, I am an anarcho nihilist. So I have completely given up on any hope or fear of anything like this. I think if everybody could just find a quiet part of the world to just go hide for a little while, you're best to doing that. If you realize through reading and a lot of reading is you get into what's called historians say deep history, and you realize that history is in cycles, and that everything you might bitch about, you know, whatever, is a continual bitch. Oh, the kids today. People have been doing that since, you know, the Roman times. They've been bitching about the generation behind them. People talk about the economy. That stuff never goes away. So what happens is you just have to kind of let it go and realize that, you know, it's there. There's trends, obviously, that might not look good depending on where you are or politically, but I've never really been a part of it. In Chicago, the politics were never a politics of choice, but they, you were told who to vote for because there really was only one person that was running. Right. It was the machine, the Chicago politic machine. You know, you were voting and you just pulled one tap, Democratic, and it was just a Democratic. In Chicago, growing up, everybody was Democratic locally, and maybe they would be center right politically nationally. You know, when Reagan came in, that was probably the first Republican that a lot of people in Chicago voted for because they just couldn't take Carter anymore. So that was the first time I started to see that, okay, wait a minute, maybe politics is like this kind of image thing. And I don't really try to get involved too much into it because I feel like the people that you see or the people that you're shaking your fist at are not the people that really are in control. And I don't mean it in a conspiracy way. What I mean is that people are put in these positions because they're people that work well with the powers that be, for right or wrong, right? There's good people too that are in politics, but I don't necessarily try to get involved in it. There was a time in Florida where I was thinking about getting involved in local politics. I had talked to somebody and he basically said, you know, well, first thing you're gonna have to do is join a church. And I was like, well, wait a minute, that's not me. I'm not really a man of faith or anything like that. I said, that's a little kind of a hypocrisy, isn't it? And he looked at me and he says, wait a minute, you're going to get into politics and you're talking already about hypocrisy? And I was like, yeah, this is not going to work out for me. So, you know, there's always that weird thing where you look at the world and you say, oh, you know. However, when you get below that level, I think everybody's doing okay because you just have to meet the people in a common space, right? You might not agree politically or economically or whatever it is. But I think there's decency everywhere. And you just have to meet the people and say, yeah, sure, so what? Maybe I don't fit or my lifestyle doesn't fit in, but come over and eat food with me. You know, break bread together. And I do think that that's a part that we're missing nowadays. And I think that's a part that we need to work on as a culture. We need to transcend these things.
Most people are wrong for the right reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it isn't because of, they're sticking to their guns because of what they believe. It's all they know. And so sometimes it's not my job to illuminate them because I know very little either. I'm getting it from the same mediums they're getting it from, right? I don't have a special password or a key, a primer that says, hey, I know what's really going on in the world. I'm getting it from New York Times or Washington Post or CNN or Fox or whatever, just like they are. But you have to realize at some point, hey, let's leave that outside. Come inside, you know, and tell me about your dog. Tell me about your kids, you know, about how proud you are of your child. And then quickly people realize, wow, everybody's just trying to figure out what the hell's life is. And if you can get to that level, then it's okay. But it's hard. We get caught in the labels, we get caught in all these other things. And you know, one of the things I've liked about the burner community is it's fairly apolitical. I have noticed in the last couple of years, politics is seeping into it. But even the people that might have been not on your side of the spectrum, I always liked having them around because it kind of was a valid point to the idea of the inclusivity of the community. And I start thinking that if you start drawing lines and saying, well, I don't agree with your politics, so therefore, how could you call yourself this and how could you be a part of our event? Then you're losing the whole thing of it, which is really the idea that it should be a mirror to the culture as it is. You know, it's I never felt Burning Man was countercultural. I always felt it was cultural, just of a different culture.
Interesting.
You know, because there was always this idea that people were like, oh, you can't say, and then I'm like, yeah, but what do you do? Oh, you work for Disney. Oh, you work for, you know, Lucasfilms, or you're part of a machine. Everybody is a part of a machine somewhere. Everybody is. It's the way the world is. And it always has been. You know, when people are like, oh, the world sucks. I'm like, well, compared to when? 1628, you know, 1120, you know, 490 BC. When was it ever better? You know, we eat better than kings ever could have. You know, the variety of choices in your daily life is astronomical. You know, entertainment is phenomenal. I mean, it's crazy. It's so at some point, you know, when people bitch and moan, I'm always like, well, why are we complaining? And usually what it is, it's I think it's expectations.
I agree.
Right. You touched on
religion, since we're talking about all the things that people don't usually talk about in public. What are your views? Do you have views that you'd like to share?
You know, I do. So I was raised Catholic. When I was 12 years old, I wanted to be a priest. I thought for some reason I just, you know, the parish I lived in had a young priest that came in. He had a mustache. I mean, that was how cool he was, you know, for the time being. Kind of looked like a weird John Holmes guy. Right. He had that little wispy John Holmes mustache. And so he came in and he was cool. He was young. He had curly hair. And, you know, he introduced the guitar mass. You know, most of the church was very Orthodox Catholic. And the guitar mass was like, you know, guitar players singing, you know, Kumbaya. And it was freaky. It was. And I was like, oh, maybe there's a part for me in this. So I went to a seminary in the summer. They had like a seminary camp you could go to. And, you know, I realized in the camp that some of these boys, they were really religious. I mean, they had the true fear of God. I didn't really have it. I was looking at it more like a career day. Like, I could be a priest. This is great. And I don't have to worry about women. I don't have to worry about all that stuff that's icky and, you know, that just doesn't really fit into the messiness of the world. I can just do my masses every day and, you know, maybe coach a basketball team, you know, whatever it is. And they brought us into a room. It's just after a couple of weeks. They brought us into a room. And I'll never forget this experience. There was a candle in the center and a priest are in the corner in the darkness. And they said, you know, we want each boy to talk about when they were called to become a priest. And I never got the call, you know. And I was like, oh, I'm hoping every boy says, I never got the call. I never got the call. I never got the call. Instead, every boy just lies, right? And says, you know, I'm riding my bicycle down the street and there's 90-foot Jesus. And he says, Timmy, be a priest. And, you know, they all had these stories. And I was eighth in line. And I remember thinking, oh, man. So it comes to me. And I said, I never got the call. I was like, I'm not going to lie here, right? That's the worst. That's like lying in confession. If you're a Catholic kid and you lie about a sin you didn't commit, that's the double. That's like, how do you even do that? Who do you confess to about that? Like, I lied in my last confession. I mean, that's kind of what it felt like.
Weird start.
Yeah, right. So afterwards, the priest came up to me and he's like, why are you here? He says, I don't think you're priest material. And I had just lost it. I remember saying, you know, those boys are liars. They're lying. It doesn't happen like that. You know, religion and spirituality, it doesn't happen like that. That's all poppycock. So he said, well, maybe you should leave. So I did. I got on the city bus. I came home and I was like, that's it. And so I never really, after that, that kind of jaded me. I went to a very good high school where we had the principal was a legitimate biblical scholar. And we spent 2 years studying the whole New Testament. And it was great hearing it from a literature standpoint, like all the reasons and all this other stuff, which is not really the Christian way of doing it. Christian is a little more of a literalist way, you know, like Jesus actually did the fishes and the loaves, or he actually walked on water. Whereas this guy was more like, hey, these stories are allegories. They're from other stories that were floating around at the time that were kind of collected and collated into this thing. And people would know this, right? It would be like if we took Spider-Man and Iron Man and the Hulk and told these stories, but we kind of interchanged the characters a little bit or changed them around. He said, that's what they did with the stories. But you can't really do that. And so I really became against religion. And when I went to the Middle East, I went to all the religious sites because I wanted to see the craziness of like what people did. As I went through this, Paul, I started realizing faith is a very personal thing. And who am I to say what's right or wrong? Right? If you believe that your dog has been sent here from heaven to help you through your day, that's wonderful. Believe it. That's your faith. That's awesome. So I kind of went through the whole arc. And now my faith is I'm like, everybody can believe whatever they want to believe. You're not trying to convince me to believe what you believe, which is great. And I kind of fall on the spectrum of like of all the things I've read, Buddhism kind of fits in for me the most. And the reason is because it's not a religion per se. It's more of a way of life and a way of perspective. And there's sort of a sense of nothingness, and there's a sense of like release. There's things that are, you can tell there's some pretty heavy thinking over thousands of years about this, you know, and same with the Hindu faith, you know, the idea that there's no duality, right? It's not a God, and there's not me separate, and there's not this judgment. It's really the unification of, you know, a non-dualistic thing. So if I were to say anything like that, I'm more attracted to that. If you were to give me a smattering of books and say, which book do you want to pick up about religion? I would go towards the Buddhist book. That's the one I would feel like, okay, I get this. But I don't necessarily like when the people go full Buddhist either, because I kind of fit and I go, well, that's good if you're in an Eastern way of thinking, but it's very hard for Westerners to do that. Like I always, one of the things I liked about the Playa was that I could kind of overlay some of my thinking of creation, destruction, birth, death, you know, all that stuff there, right? It's become kind of indirectly, this might be morbid to say it, but it's kind of become a mortuary society. We've gotten really good at celebrating the passing of people that we love in ways that maybe we wouldn't have before, right? You go into the temple on the Playa, it's a very intense experience. I mean, even more so if you have a reason to be in there. You know, but if you're in there, you know, I will tell you this, never, ever take mushrooms in the day and go into the temple. It's an intense experience that you'll never forget. Don't do it. You know, it is it is the well of grief. And you feel it in such a way that you're like, oh, my God, this was the biggest mistake I could make today, was to come in here, because you are connecting with all the empathetic wavelengths of so much sadness and grief and loss. And you start really reading everything and you start pouring over everything and you're like, oh my God, this is too much. But it's a great outlet, right? So you look at those things and you say to yourself, okay, so where does that fit into my life, is to do those things, is to have that sense of ceremony and to have that sense of honor. Because you can reject all the religions that you have, but I still think you should have traditions and ceremonies in your life. You should have little things that you do that you just kind of, you know, do those things. Like I have a chicken graveyard in my backyard now. And I always say the same thing after the chickens are gone. I put them in the hole and I always say, as you go, so soon will I. And to me, that's my little way of just saying like, yeah, you know, I'm aware that, you know, things are fleeting and passing, and, you know, you're dead and someday I will be too.
That's beautiful.
It's a momenti mori thing, right? A momenti mori thing where you just kind of remind yourself that each day is precious. You know, every day is a gift.
Well, I'm tempted to, let's see, maybe you touched on drugs a couple of times. Let's talk about that, and then we'll ask you for some final thoughts on life.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny, because growing up, as I grew up, it was, you know, I came from a family of drinkers. And so I was very hyper aware of drinking. I always am. You know, it's something to me that I would like to put in a box and get rid of for good. And I'm getting close to it. And so it was always this thing where I was like, oh man, what does that look like? You know, and I can remember kids, you know, you would hear about a kid that smoked marijuana and two neighborhoods over, you know, and you'd be like, oh my God, you know, that's it for that kid. He's going to jail and hell and everything else. So drugs were never really something that was there. And then when I got a little older, I was very lucky to kind of bypass all the drugs. So I'm that 3% of people that if I smoke a joint, I just fall asleep. I just want to go to bed. I don't get stoned. I don't get high. I don't like being stoned. So I don't do pot. I think I've done it three or four times in my life. It's just not, for me, an enjoyable experience. However, like LSD and shrooms, that's I'm in my wheelhouse. That is the go-to, like default state that I'm in, most comfortable. And the more the merrier. You know, there's microdosing, I'm a macrodoser. But it's become so infrequent now because I need it less and less. Right. So once you break yourself from the desire of it, then you ask yourself, okay, do I want it? And you don't even want it anymore. Like, it's funny. It's just like sobriety. It's more than just like cleaning up your act and getting away from whatever. It's also the idea that I don't need these things. They were great teachers. They were great helpers. But they're not necessarily things that you're getting anything out of anymore. That your day-to-day stuff is where you really can get in there. And, you know, I saw somebody write years ago, they said that drugs are like a rocket ship that take you around an orbit of the final goal, but then bring you right back to it, bring you right back to the launch pad. And then you, once it shows you where the moon is, right, and you kind of went around the moon, it showed you, hey, this is how far it is, how you can get there and all this stuff. Then it brings you back to the launch pad. Then it's up to you on your own to get there, not using the drugs. So it's weird. Like, you can always see, and we've all seen it, where you see people going too far into it, right? There's a constant searching or a seeking, or they just feel like they're not getting the answers that they really want. And once again, it kind of goes into measured expectations, right? There's always you have a voice that comes to you when you have these experiences, and it kind of tells you a lot of things. For me, it always tells me, hey, move around a lot more and eat more green stuff, you know, eat more salad. You know, it's always basic stuff. It's always healthy, right? It's like, hey, you need to, you know, lose 20 pounds and eat more green stuff. And then there's always this like a connectedness of look around, be present, and, you know, and see nature for what it is. And I always think of that as like I look at that and I think, oh, that's what they're good for, is you start looking into like, so there's two main philosophies that I see that happen in a lot of cultures, is that there's a heavier shamanistic one, right? Where somebody imparts knowledge to you, there's a shaman and a wise teacher. But then there's this other weird one, which is the trickster. And that's the one I kind of fall into, which is, you know, that thing can be revealed to you where there's no bottom, right? The bottom's taken away from underneath your feet. You kind of fall a little, you trip, and you learn through that way, right? There's a embarrassment. There's a social aspect of tricksterism that to me is how I kind of answer to it. So I've never really been following the shamanistic way of, you know, a lot of the new age stuff that occurs. I tend to go through more of it's a little harsher path, I think, tricksterism, because it really requires you to open up and really, really confront like the ridiculous parts of who you are, because we all have those. Where we're like, dude, look at you. Who the fuck do you think you are? You know, and that part of it. So drugs is really good because it teaches you how to do that. And then you don't need the drugs anymore. So if you're lucky, you should have a great respect for them. And you should have it. And that's why I don't do them at the events anymore. Because it's just too much. It gets in the way of me running into you and saying, hey, how's things going? Or what's going on there? Right. And then if you messed up, it's like, who are you talking to? You're talking to somebody on a trip. I mean, there's a time and a place for it, I guess. If you want to enhance something, maybe take a little light dose. But, you know, for the most part, I think it should be something that's almost a solitary thing. You know, put on some comfortable sweatpants and just go sit in darkness somewhere. And don't do anything crazy. No music, no whatever. And just be still with your thoughts and think these things through. You're always better for it. And I always am, you know, every 2 years, you come through it, and it's a cleansing of sorts. But the idea of just doing it to get messed up doesn't have any appeal to me anymore.
That's fascinating. I couldn't agree more. I feel like we just scratched the surface. I know that I could probably...
And I hope that, you know, what I want to do is do the flip where I could then interview you, because I know, you know, I've listened to a lot of these recordings, and I get little glimpses of who you are. And I would think, man, this would be great if we could kind of flip it and people could hear about you, because you're a very good, you know, listener and ask some great questions. But also you have your own things. And I think it's important for you to kind of, you know, have a voice and people see that, because that's all part of the process.
We'll do that. We'll do that someday. That's great. Not right now.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. And I know I'd be honored to be interviewed by you someday. I think you'd do a great job of it. And frankly, there were so many overlaps and things that you said that that's what I'm thinking. We could probably talk for about 12 hours just
each
of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you're a male at a certain stage in your life and you have applied certain things and tried certain things and done it, whether it's business or life experiences or, you know, relationships, you can kind of say, oh, my God. And you're like, me too, me too, me too. And after a while, the conversation should just be a giant head nodding back and forth, you know, because we can probably do this all day long and be like, oh, I had a similar experience with that.
So, I've been asking the questions, but to a certain extent, you have things that this is, you know, as we close this thing out, are there things that you would just like to tell people to get across? Do you have a few things that
I would like, if I could say anything, it would be, we're just getting started. And I don't mean like, you know, Love Burn or Burning Man, none of that stuff. I mean, like in your life is the idea that you're just getting started, that tomorrow it could be a whole new thing. And I think a lot of times people at a certain stage in their life feel like, and I've wrestled with this, I've gotten in this severe funk because I felt like it's over. You know, now it's just like a waiting room of your life. And it's not true. That if you can get through this, if you can get through that funk that occurs at certain stages of your life, women have it, men have it. If you can get through that, it's just getting started. You know, you're really clipping along. You know who you are. You know, you know who you're not, which is just important. You're just getting started. And to have the enthusiasm to greet your day and to do those things. And that's, I think that's the hardest lesson of all, is to not give up. You know, is to apply yourself, do these things, and try to find those that's sort of special that gives you a reason, you know, gives you a sense of hope, because it is pretty dismal out there. And it seems dismal. And we're constantly bombarded by bleakness and, you know, all the crappy shit that we don't want to be a part of in the world. But it's really, it can get better. That's I tell that to myself every day. Every morning I get up, I lay in bed, and I have a little gratitude exercise I try to do. Basically, I'm just thankful for being here, to still be experiencing life. And, you know, I think of all the people in our lives that are not here that would give anything just for one more day. You know, one more day to just look around, take a walk, do something, you know. And I think, man, you know, we get so crazed in our heads with all the stuff that we think about and all the problems, all the issues. Sometimes you just have to declutter it and clear it out and say, you know, just one more day. I'm just going to, you know, today's going to be that day. Look around and just be present. And that's it.
Thank you. It's an honor to have you in my circle of friends, and an honor for.
Yeah, we're just getting started. You know, this is a fun thing. It's going to be, I think people are getting better as they get older. You know, sometimes we hang on to the young and go, oh my God, look how much better we're now. I think when we're all 75 years old and we're just chuckling because of the inside secrets of all the crazy messed up stuff that we've done all our lives, that's the secret, right? You don't care. You don't have to impress anybody. This is the age. This is the stage.
We can hope. Maybe that's when we have the best orgy. So
that's it, right? It's just, and then you just kind of hang it out, right? Then you want to go make a sandwich.
Okay. All right. We'll go ahead and we'll close off here. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul.